Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are launching into a truly critical subject, pediatric emergency medicine. You know, for many clinicians, there's this knee-jerk assumption that a child is just a smaller version of an adult. But that belief is, frankly, dangerous.
It really is. It's probably the single biggest misconception we see. Our mission, really, in this deep dive, is to just get rid of that idea completely. We're going to identify the fundamental differences, the ones that are often counterintuitive in pediatric anatomy, physiology, and, yeah, even emotional response.
Right.
Understand these distinctions. Well, it can be the difference between catching those early signs of compensated illness and missing the really rapid onset of collapse.
It demands a whole paradigm shift, doesn't it? Because every single assessment, every intervention, it's dictated by the child's developmental stage.
Exactly.
We probably need to remind ourselves of these specific stages just briefly, because how you approach a one-month-old neonate is just worlds apart from dealing with a 17-year-old adolescent.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So we're looking at the neonate, that's the first month, then the infant, up to 12 months, the toddler, ages 1 to 2, preschoolers, 3 to 5, then school age, 6 to 12, and finally adolescence, which is 13 up to 18. And across these stages, developmental traits, social factors, physical characteristics, they all change dramatically. It impacts everything, you know, from how they show pain to just basic things like body temperature regulation.
Okay, let's start with the physical differences, the ones that, you know, hit you immediately, beginning right at the head. An infant or young child's head is, well, it's massive compared to their body, proportionally speaking. What does that mean in, say, a trauma setting? And what about just for routine care?
Well, that disproportionate size means two really big things. Clinically, in trauma, yeah, the neck and the spinal column are just inherently more vulnerable. The mechanical forces are different. But even just in a routine assessment, you have to recognize the increased risk of hypothermia. Because the head is so large and has so much blood flow, they lose heat incredibly fast. Keeping a child warm isn't just comfort, it's a baseline priority.
Mm-hmm. And as long as those fontanelles, the soft spots, are open in infancy, they give us a kind of window into internal pressure. But they're also a pretty high-risk area themselves.
That's right.
Moving down to the airway. Okay, this is where we see some major differences that can make visualization and management pretty challenging.
Yeah, the pediatric airway is smaller, it's narrower, the neck's shorter. And the epiglottis, that little flap covering the windpipe, it's longer and kind of floppy compared to an adult's. A key mistake people make is assuming the same positioning works. You absolutely must avoid neck hyperextension in infants and young kids. That can actually block the airway because of their anatomy. The correct position is often called the sniffing position.
Okay. And then there's the skin itself and the whole body surface area issue. That seems like a huge vulnerability.
It is, absolutely. Children have thinner, more elastic skin and significantly less subcutaneous fat, you know, the body's natural insulation layer. But the really crucial factor is that high body surface area, the BSA to weight ratio. They just have much more surface area relative to their body mass.
Right.
And this isn't just a, like, fun fact. It's a life-saving fact. It means their risk of hypothermia just skyrockets.
Mm-hmm.
And for burn patients, the severity of a burn covering, say 10% of their body, is drastically higher than it would be in an adult.
So given all this delicate anatomy, how do we actually do a rapid, effective assessment without immediately making them more anxious? Because anxiety can mask critical symptoms, right?
Yeah, exactly. We use an age-appropriate strategy.
Yeah.
If the child is calm when you first arrive, you absolutely capitalize on that quiet time. Listen to the heart and lungs first. That quiet window is golden. Because once they start crying, hearing those sounds accurately, it's almost impossible.
And what about the behavioral approach? How do you handle that?
You tailor it. For toddlers, you know, ages 1 to 2, they're often busy, maybe a bit defiant. They're usually safest and calmest sitting right on a parent's lap.
Yeah.
So you assess them there. For school-age kids and adolescents, you really have to respect their growing need for privacy, for modesty, and physically.
Yeah.
Get down on their level. Literally and figuratively, it helps build some rapport.
Okay, that makes sense. And the foundational tool that kind of ties all this initial observation together, that's the rapid fire visual check, the pediatric assessment triangle, or PTO2. It's entirely observational, done in just seconds.
The PIT is like the clinician's superpower for quickly triaging severity. It's built on just three visual things: appearance, work of breathing, and circulation to skin. And appearance, how the child interacts, how consolable they are, how alert they seem. That's arguably the most critical component.
Well, why appearance? Why is that one so critical?
Because it immediately gives you a snapshot of their central nervous system function and, importantly, their perfusion. If they look grossly abnormal, like limp, unresponsive, floppy, That is a massive red flag. It overrides everything else. It demands immediate life support and transport, pretty much regardless of their vital signs at that moment.
So if appearance is abnormal, you basically bypass the detailed exam and go straight to life support. If they look okay, then you move to work of breathing, looking for nasal flaring retraction.
Exactly. And then circulation to skin checking for those perfusion clues like pallor, mottling, or cyanosis. The PTI findings, they drive that crucial decision. Is this child stable enough for a full head-to-toe assessment right now, or do we need to stabilize and get moving immediately?
Okay, let's move to the engine room, so to speak, because this is where the sheer speed of pediatric collapse can become, well, frighteningly evident. We know children have smaller oxygen reserves, that functional residual capacity, but the real kicker seems to be their metabolic rate.
Yeah, the metabolic oxygen demand of a child is nearly double that of an adult. Double. They burn through oxygen at an incredible rate, but they have minimal reserves to pull from.
Yeah.
That's really the root of the problem. If they stop breathing effectively, even for a moment, they just fall off that oxygen cliff so rapidly.
And infants specifically have another vulnerability just in how they physically breathe, right?
Right. Yes. Infants rely heavily on their diaphragm to breathe. And the diaphragm is mostly a type 2 muscle fiber built for short bursts of activity, not long endurance. So you combine that high oxygen demand with a muscle that fatigues relatively quickly. It's just a recipe for fast respiratory failure. When kids become hypoxic, it rapidly progresses to bradycardia, a slow heart rate, and then cardiovascular collapse. This is why something like 75% of pediatric cardiac arrests come from respiratory failure or shock, not a primary heart rhythm problem like you often see in adults.
That's such a critical point. Fix the breathing, and you often fix the cardiac issue. Okay, let's shift to the cardiovascular system then, and this dangerous way they mask shock.
Right. Children possess these incredible, really vigorous cardiac reserves. They maintain their cardiac output almost entirely by dramatically jacking up their pulse rate tachycardia. So they can be in severe shock, losing blood, septic, badly dehydrated, and look deceptively stable. They can maintain a normal blood pressure for a surprisingly long time.
They're essentially playing a physiological shell game, and you really don't want to lose that game. Clinically, what this means is by the time their compensation fails and that blood pressure finally drops, well, hypotension is an ominous and catastrophically late sign.
Precisely. If a child is hypotensive, they are in decompensated shock. They're about to arrest. This is a five-alarm emergency. It needs immediate, aggressive resuscitation right there on scene. We even have a formula, a sort of line in the sand, for minimal acceptable systolic pressure, 70 plus, two times the age in years. So if you see a three-year-old with a systolic pressure below 76, they're crashing.
And for the most common type of shock in young kids, hypervolemic shock, often from dehydration or blood loss, the answer is volume.
Rapid aggressive volume replacement. Using isotonic fluids like normal saline or lactated Ringers, that's the gold standard. You have to push fluid quickly to try and reverse that process before that final decompensation happens.
Moving on to the central nervous system, we touched on the fragility of the skull and spine, but internally the differences are just as critical. The pediatric brain itself is distinct structurally and physiologically.
That's right. The neural tissue is fragile, and here's a fact that's, well, pretty staggering. The pediatric brain gets nearly twice the blood flow compared to an adult brain.
Wow. Twice the blood flow. Why is that so clinically significant for us?
It means that even a relatively minor injury, especially combined with hypoxia or hypotension, can have far-reaching and really rapid consequences. That increased blood flow makes the brain extremely sensitive to secondary insults, things like low oxygen or low blood pressure hitting it. It increases the risk of swelling, cerebral edema, and rising intracranial pressure much faster than you typically see in an adult.
And thinking about spinal trauma, the mechanism of injury really means we have to maintain a high index of suspicion, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The fulcrum, you know, the point of greatest flexion in the spine, it's higher up in young children compared to adults. C2, C3 level, often. So with any significant mechanism car accidents, falls especially, you just have to assume a cervical spine injury, maintain rigid immobilization until they're cleared definitively at the hospital.
Okay. Now let's talk about the great metabolic vulnerability, glucose.
Yeah, this is a big one. Children have incredibly limited stores of glycogen and glucose. Think of it like they have tiny gas tanks but really inefficient engines. If they get sick or injured and stop eating or drinking normally, they burn through those fuel stores incredibly quickly. Hypoglycemia, that's abnormally low blood glucose, can set in fast, and it can lead to irreversible brain damage.
So whenever a child presents with altered mental status, AMS, checking their blood glucose isn't just a good idea, it's non-negotiable.
Absolutely non-negotiable.
And to make sure we don't miss common causes of AMS, we often use that mnemonic, AEIOU-TIPS. Maybe we should quickly walk through that for our listeners.
Good idea. AEIOU-TIPS is basically your differential diagnosis checklist for AMS. So A is for alcohol or acidosis. E is epilepsy, electrolytes, or encephalitis. I is insulin, meaning hypoglycemia, which is key. O is overdose or oxygen deprivation. U is for uremia, kidney failure, or underdose of critical medications. T is trauma or temperature extremes. I is infection like meningitis. P is poisoning or psychiatric issues. And S is shock, stroke, or space-occupying lesions like a tumor. It just helps make sure you systematically think through the wide range of possibilities.
Got it. And a major cause of AMS we see is seizures. We know about generalized and partial seizures, but the classic pediatric emergency is the febrile seizure.
Right. Febrile seizures typically happen in kids between about 3 months and 6 years old. They're triggered by a high fever, but crucially, there's no identifiable cause for the seizure itself, like an infection in the brain or trauma. They're often benign in the long run, but they are absolutely terrifying for parents to witness.
And if a seizure goes on too long, say past the 4 or 5 minute mark, it becomes status epilepticus. What's the immediate management priority there?
Airway first. Always airway. Then check the glucose immediately. Benzodiazepines like lorazepam or diazepam are the go-to treatment to try and stop the seizure activity. And here's a really crucial caveat. You should never attempt endotracheal intubation while a child is actively seizing. You're far more likely to cause injury than to secure the airway safely. Wait until the seizure stops or the medication starts working.
Good point. Finally, in this section, we have to mention meningitis, inflammation of the meninges. It's a true life threat, and it often presents really vaguely, especially in the very young ones.
Yeah, in infants, you might just see lethargy, irritability, maybe poor feeding, really non-specific signs. But in older children, you look for the more classic signs. Neck stiffness, photophobia, sensitivity to light, and sometimes that really ominous sign, the petechial or purpuric rash, little red or purple spots that don't blanch when you press on them. That suggests meningococcal sepsis. This can move so incredibly fast. Immediate recognition and transport are absolutely vital.
Okay, given that respiratory issues really lead the charge in pediatric collapse, let's get specific about airway management. How do we oxygenate a child who's thrashing, terrified, and just won't tolerate a standard oxygen mask?
Yeah, that's common. We absolutely must use supplemental oxygen for any child in respiratory distress. If they won't tolerate a mask clamped on their face, use the blow-by technique. Basically, you hold the oxygen source, like the end of the tubing, or a non-rebreather mask held loosely near their face, just close enough so they breathe in the oxygen-enriched air. It delivers high-flow oxygen without the physical constraint, which can really reduce their anxiety.
Right, okay. And if that's not enough and you need to move to bag mask ventilation or BMV?
Key differences here, too. You need to deliver breaths at a rate of 20 to 30 breaths per minute for infants and children. That's significantly faster than the adult rate. And ideally, whenever possible, use two-person BMV. One person focuses just on getting a perfect mask seal, using both hands if needed, while the second person squeezes the bag. This is vastly more effective at delivering good positive pressure breaths.
And intubation. That's really the last resort, right? Only if BMV fails, or maybe if transport is going to be very long, and it needs specific small-scale pediatric gear.
Exactly. You must have the correct equipment ready and know the sizes. Laryngoscope blades typically range from size 0 for neonates up to size 3 for older children. And the endotracheal tubes, the ET tubes, are tiny, ranging from 2.5 millimeters up to maybe 6.0 millimeters. And importantly, once you've intubated a child, if they suddenly deteriorate, you need a quick troubleshooting mnemonic. We use DOPE.
Okay, let's unpack DOPE quickly.
Sure. D stands for displacement. The tube is moved, maybe into the esophagus or main stem bronchus. O is for obstruction, could be mucus, blood, or maybe the tube is kinked. P is for pneumothorax, a collapsed lung, maybe from the initial injury or even caused by the ventilation. And E is for equipment failure. Is the oxygen disconnected? Is the bag or ventilator malfunctioning? It's just a rapid-fire mental checklist that can save lives in that critical moment.
Makes sense. Okay, shifting gears slightly to common pitfalls outside of trauma. Toxicology.
Mm-hmm.
Toxic exposures, whether kids ingest something or inhale it, that's a major pediatric emergency category.
It really is. And when you're dealing with a potential poisoning or unknown substance, time is absolutely critical. Never hesitate. Call the National Poison Center Hotline. That number is 1-800-222-1222. Even if you think you know the protocol for a substance, calmness is vital. Management can be complex and depends entirely on the specific substance, the estimated dose, and how long ago the exposure happened. They have the most up-to-date information.
Good reminder. We should also probably briefly highlight two critical surgical emergencies that can present acutely in young children, things providers need to have on their radar.
Definitely. The first one is intussusception. It's often described as the bowel telescoping into itself. It causes severe, colicky, intermittent abdominal pain. Kids might draw their knees up to their chest, and it often presents with that classic sign, current jelly-like stools, which is basically blood mixed with mucus. The second one is pyloric stenosis. This is typically seen in infants, usually a few weeks old. It's an overgrowth of the muscle at the stomach outlet causing a blockage. The hallmark sign is forceful, non-bilious, meaning no green bile projectile vomiting, often immediately after feeding. Both of these need urgent evaluation, usually involving imaging and likely surgical intervention.
Okay. And finally, let's address something really sensitive but absolutely crucial, child abuse and neglect. This requires extreme sensitivity but also mandatory attention, right?
Yes. Pre-hospital personnel, like EMTs and paramedics, carry a legal obligation in most places to report suspicion of abuse or neglect. This isn't optional. It's mandated by law. We look for inconsistencies, a history provided by the caregiver that just doesn't quite match the clinical picture, or injuries that seem beyond what a child could normally do at their developmental stage.
What are some specific suspicious findings we should be looking for?
Well, suspicious bruising is a big one, particularly bruises that are in multiple stages of healing, suggesting repeated injury over time. Or bruises in concerning locations, the torso, the ears, the neck, and infants. Sometimes injuries might even mirror the shape of an object, like a loop mark from a cord. However, and this is really important, you must always maintain a differential diagnosis. Remember to evaluate common mimics. Things like cultural practices, coining, or cupping can leave marks that look like bruises, or certain birthmarks, like Mongolian spots, which are common and can look bruise-like. The goal is always a thorough, objective, unbiased evaluation and reporting suspicion when warranted.
Understood. And our final logistical note involves transporting children who have special healthcare needs. If they have complex issues, say, a central line, a tracheostomy, maybe a ventricular shunt for hydrocephalus.
Yeah, for those kids, if it's feasible and safe, they should ideally be transported to their medical home. That's the facility, usually a children's hospital, that knows their history and is best equipped to handle their specific chronic conditions alongside the acute problem. And regardless of where you transport them, the caregiver must come with the child if at all possible. They are the absolute expert on that child's baseline condition, their medications, their allergies. Their knowledge is completely indispensable for the emergency team. Hashtag outro.
Wow. What a crucial deep dive. We've covered so much ground, from the tiny, vulnerable airway all the way to the high-stakes risk of mask shock.
Yeah, and the overriding principles, they really have to stick with you. Pediatric care is just not small adult care. Assessment has to be driven by developmental stage and that initial PATE. You have to understand that hypoxia causes collapse much faster. And crucially, remember that hypotension is a late, almost terminal sign of shock. You absolutely must act aggressively while they are still compensating.
That distinction, right, compensated versus crashing, that's what this entire discussion really hinges on. And that leaves us with our final thought for you, the learner. Given this unique physiological setup we've discussed, where cardiac arrest is almost always secondary to respiratory failure, and where children mask shock signs until they are right on the brink, which single component of that initial hands-off observation, the pediatric assessment triangle appearance, work of breathing, or circulation to skin should always be the very first and most fiercely scrutinized indication that a child might be moving from compensated illness toward the edge of catastrophe?
Think about the finding that gives you the fastest, most reliable clue about their brain function and their overall physiological reserve without even needing to touch them initially.
The answer really is, and it must always be, appearance. It immediately dictates the urgency of your intervention and your next steps. Thank you for taking this crucial deep dive with us today. We really hope you feel far more prepared to approach these most delicate patients.